you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Speak Out with Tim Wise. I am your host. It is Tuesday, May the 5th of 2020, as I record this, and I appreciate you joining me for this, a regular episode of the show. If you are interested in becoming a patron and sustainer of Speak Out with Tim Wise, you can do that at patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. And over there, for as little as $2 a month, you can become a patron and sustainer, and that will get you access to additional bonus commentaries that are not part of the regular program. For 5 or 10 or 20 or more per month, you can receive more commentaries, additional content, downloadable materials, tapes, books. Eventually, we're going to be offering webinars and classes that you can take for the somewhat higher monthly amounts. But even for as little as $2 a month, you can get access to some bonus material. And more importantly, you can support the anti-racist commentary and education that I'm doing here on a weekly basis, hopefully on a daily basis, at least through the course of the lockdown, trying to do as much of this as I possibly can to sort of keep up, you know, with the day's events and the week's events. Lots of things happening related to the issues that I regularly talk about, race and class and inequality in America. So again, thank you very much. If you're already a patron or sustainer of the show, if you're not, jump over to patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. If in fact that's not where you're already listening to this, it may be. But if you're listening to it on Podomatic, or you're listening to it at Apple Podcast, or anywhere you get your podcast, make sure to hop over to Speak Out with Tim Wise at patreon.com and become a sustainer and supporter of the program. Today, I want to do something. I want to take my time with it, and I want to go through some things that I think are important to say as we enter probably the second week now, maybe third week, of anti-lockdown protest around the country. I have already done a few bonus commentaries on this where I have discussed the extremist nature of some of the individuals and the know-nothing anti-scientific ignorance of many of the individuals who have been involved in these rallies, the anti-vaxxers, the folks who think that the whole thing is just one big hoax, the people who in Pennsylvania drove through with the truck that said, "Jesus is my vaccine," you know, the people who apparently think that stay-at-home orders are the equivalent of communism or alternately Nazism and don't really understand the difference. The people in Illinois the other day who had the work sets you free signs written, of course, in German, the Arbeit macht frei, that was the sign above Auschwitz as a way to sort of mock the stay-at-home orders, not noting the irony, of course, that it's the anti-lockdown folks who apparently think work makes you free. It's they who were saying to people, oh, it's safe, please come work, which is exactly what the Nazis were saying to the Jews as they brought them into the death camp. So these people don't understand their history. They don't understand the analogy they're making. But I've spent a lot of time in the last 2 weeks critiquing the ignorance of these folks. I want to step back from that for a second, not because I take any of it back. I meant every word, and I say it again. But because I do realize that there are people not like the Yahoos, not like these, frankly, lunatic folks who were showing up at these rallies, who nonetheless are amenable to, I guess, the core message that they are putting forward. Because the core message they're putting forward is not an extremist message. It's a pretty mainstream message. It's one that Donald Trump himself is articulating when he talks about reopening the economy. It's one that, of course, the governor and lieutenant governor of Texas have both articulated. The lieutenant governor saying, for instance, Dan Patrick, you know, there are certain things more important than life. He's on the record as saying that. We have Chris Christie, who's normally thought of as a reasonable Republican, who about a week ago had an op-ed in the Washington Post that actually was pretty reasonable, and I actually said so on Twitter, tweeted at him to thank him for the reasonableness of his piece. It was one where he was talking about the importance of a slow rollout, but also the importance of recognizing the dangers. And I asked him in that tweet thread, it was two or three tweets long, I asked him a question that, of course, he did not respond to, nor did any of his spokespersons who manage or monitor his Twitter account see fit to respond. And today I know why, because I read today that he has now come out and said, he said last night on one of the news programs, I guess, that, you know, we're just going to have to accept a significant increase in death so as to maintain the American way of life. And he equated it to World War II. He actually made a direct analogy to the soldiers who were sent to fight Nazism or Japanese imperialism in World War II, knowing as we sent them there that some were not going to make it. And he said the same thing is true now. We have to be willing to lose life to maintain the American way of living, that our way of life is worth defending now just like it was then. And I just realized, you know, it took Chris Christie a week to backpedal and to come to this mentality that, oh, well, we're just going to have to sacrifice a bunch of lives. He had taken a much more moderate stance a week or so ago in the Post. And I guess this is now becoming the new mainstream argument for Republicans, the new mainstream argument for conservatives. We just got to open everything back up and let the chips fall where they may. It is pretty disconcerting to think that we're going to equate the sacrifice that Chris Christie is now calling for, and that the governor of Texas, lieutenant governor of Texas, Donald Trump himself, and so many others are calling for, with the sacrifice made by soldiers in World War II, as if there's no difference between sending people to fight fascism and a genocidal dictator, Adolf Hitler, on the one hand, and sending people out to be able to get haircuts and go back to sit-down restaurants on the other, right? I'm sorry, the salad bar at Ruby Tuesdays can wait, and it's not the equivalent of the beaches at Normandy, but whatever. But that's sort of where we are. And I want to, for the sake of today's program, I want to put aside to the greatest extent possible the sarcasm, the snark, and the attacks on these folks who were at these protests. And I want to just start with the assumption that there are a lot of good people. And by the way, I'm not just assuming it. I'm sure this is true. That there are a lot of good and decent people who are not necessarily at all on board with the messaging of these protests. They are appalled by the Confederate flag symbolism, by the militia-type symbolism, by people showing up in camo with guns and anti-vax signs. I'm sure there are good, reasonable people, maybe not even that right-wing, frankly, maybe not even that ultra-conservative, who are just simply afraid right now. They're afraid of the consequences, understandably, of extending the large-scale economic shutdown of huge sectors of our country into the summer. And it is understandable for people to be afraid of that. We know, for instance, that unfortunately, and all of us on the left have talked about this for a very long time, we live in a society where a huge number of Americans don't even have $500 saved. So they certainly don't have enough saved to get through multiple months without steady income and a $1,200 per adult, $500 per child one-time payment for those families, which is all that up to now has been authorized, simply isn't going to do it. Extended unemployment benefits of $600 a week federal addition to whatever your state pays, but that's only through July. And then it just reverts back to whatever your state average is. And if you live in a lot of states in this country, like Tennessee, where my family lives, the maximum you can receive in our state is like $275 a week or something. Clearly not enough to sustain people. The Paycheck Protection Program, clearly still having problems with the rollout, people getting approved, people being able to access sufficient funds through that. You had the Small Business Administration Emergency Disaster Loan Program that both my wife and I, by the way, applied for because we've lost work too. But they only give out $1,000 per employee. So if you're an independent contractor, which I am, if you're an independent contractor, which my wife is, that means the most we're going to get off that is $2,000. We've already gotten half of that, still waiting on the other half. So clearly, look, I understand why people are afraid about the financial picture moving forward if the lockdown continues. I am in the same place in my head. It is a very frightening thing when you've lost a vast amount of your income, as my family has lost. So I'm going to start with the assumption that there are a lot of people who are there. They're not the folks who think the whole thing is a hoax. They know it's real. They know it's dangerous. But they simply feel as though, look, we gotta, sort of like the Chris Christie argument. Maybe they wouldn't analogize it to fighting the Nazis, but they would say, look, he's right, you know, some people are gonna die, but we have to be prepared to sacrifice to, you know, sort of get back to some level of normalcy. And people do have to work. I wanna try to take that argument as seriously as possible, based on the assumption that it comes from good faith. I think for some people it doesn't. I think some of the protesters really are folks who believe it's just a big hoax intended to hurt the president. And if you think that, you're an idiot. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the people who have genuine concerns, understandable concerns. And I want to walk through those. And I want to talk about what it all means and how I think we ought to be thinking about this in this moment. And I hope that if you're hearing this and you're one of those folks who understands the dangers of COVID-19, but is also really nervous about the financial piece, the economic piece, that you'll be able to hear what I have to say in the spirit that it is intended, and knowing that I too and my family are ones who are also worried and also concerned about the financial piece. We're not people who are sitting on vast reserves of cash that we can call upon to get through a long sustained lockdown. So the idea that somehow, you know, all of us who are wanting to stay sheltered in place must be rich and have all kinds of money at our disposal, that just isn't true, you know. So I want to have this conversation on the basis of good faith. So notice, first of all, in Chris Christie's argument and the argument of the people I'm talking about, what they will say, what they are saying is, listen, obviously, people with pre-existing conditions who are in high-risk groups, they should stay sheltered in place. They should feel free to continue quarantining because there's real risk. And the elderly, you know, people who are older, that's a high-risk group. They should continue to quarantine and self-isolate because they're at real risk. I've heard that argument made by people very compassionately. Yes, those folks need to stay at home, but the rest of us should be able to get back to work. A couple of thoughts about that. First thought, the implicit underlying assumption there is that if all the other people go back to work, the ones who aren't elderly, because keep in mind, some older folks do have jobs, right? They're not all retirees. If all the people who, you know, don't have diabetes, don't have high blood pressure, don't have a heart condition, don't have asthma, don't have a body mass index of 30 or more, making them technically obese and putting them in a high risk group. If all the generally healthy, non-elderly folks go back, then everything will be okay. The implicit assumption is those people, by going back to work, will not increase the risk to the other folks who remain sheltered in place. And so everybody wins, right? The healthy go back, the young go back, the people with pre-existing conditions and the older folks stay home and everybody wins. But that's not true for a couple of reasons. Number one, if the quote-unquote younger and healthier and whatever people go back, some of them are going to get, a lot of them actually are going to get the virus, and some statistically are going to die. Not an insignificant number, by the way, are going to die. But they're also going to get infected, and then by virtue of the uptick in overall cases, they are going to make things more dangerous, even for the people who remain largely sheltered in place, because those who were remaining largely sheltered in place, it's not like they're going to become shut-ins, right? Even through the existing quarantine, these are still folks who go to the grocery. There's still folks who have mail delivered and other packages delivered. There's still people who go to Target or they go to Walmart or they go to Costco. These are still people who get out and do a few things. Very few people have been completely in sort of, you know, solitary confinement. Even people who've been following the lockdown and who have a pre-existing condition still get out in the world, albeit with caution and maybe a mask, right? So if... And part of the reason they've been able to do that is that because most people are following shelter-in-place orders, the R-naught, which is the scientific term for the virality, the transmissibility of the virus, has dropped, right? When fewer people are out interacting, your transmissibility rate drops. The R-naught of this particular virus drops, and as a result, it becomes safer for people, even if they are somewhat compromised in terms of health. They can go to the Target. They can go to the store. They can be out in the world. They don't have to just sit in their house all day. So if you let millions of supposedly healthy and younger people go back to work, the R-naught is going to increase. And it's going to increase dramatically. And not only will some of those younger and healthier people get sick and die, which, hey, you know, if they want to take the risk, I mean, they do have the right to do that to themselves. But the problem is that R-naught increasing will now increase the risk to the people who didn't choose to go back out to work, but who occasionally do get out in the world. Unless you're saying to them, all the old folks, just stay in your house, never go outside. Don't go to the grocery. Don't go anywhere. People who have any kind of pre-existing condition don't go anywhere, and I don't see anyone really arguing that, then what you're saying is not just that these folks want to be able to take the risk for themselves, but they want to take a risk for themselves which will increase risk to others. The second problem with the idea that we can have these folks over here go back and these folks over here can stay home is that some of the folks who are going back live with the people who need to stay home. It's not as if American households are neatly divided into households that look like, you know, your local gym where everybody's in shape and healthy on the one hand versus, you know, the ICU ward where everyone is on death's door, right? We usually live in households with a mixture of people where some people are in high-risk groups and other people are not. So you might have a family, for instance, where the parents are generally healthy, but they've got a kid who's immunocompromised or who has asthma or who has diabetes. What do those parents do? Do they fall in the group that needs to quote unquote get back to work and should be expected to go back, or and thereby go back and potentially bring this back to their immunocompromised or asthmatic child or diabetic child? Or do they stay sheltered in place so as to protect that child, even though they're healthy, but then as a result, they lose their job, they lose their income, now their family can't pay their bills. You know, we tend to live in mixed homes. Our home is a good example of this. So I have asthma. Our youngest daughter has asthma. So we both fall into that high-risk group. I have slightly high blood pressure, not high enough to require blood pressure medication, but borderline, so sort of a risk group. So what do we do? You know, we have two people in the house who then fall into high-risk groups. My wife and our older daughter don't. But how do we navigate that? Our family's pretty typical that way. Most people live in mixed. A lot of people have their parents living with them. You know, they have multiple generation households. You got people, very, very rarely do you have a family where everyone's healthy or everyone's sick. So the idea that these folks can go back, but these folks can shelter in place and never the two shall meet just isn't true. So now if a lot of people go back and the R-naught increases and the transmissibility rate increases, those healthy people who catch it, yeah, they may not die. They may not even show symptoms. They may remain asymptomatic, but then they bring it back into their home where their diabetic kid gets it and now the child is in real trouble. Or where the grandparent lives, now the grandparent's in real trouble. Or the, you know, spouse or partner with COPD, you know what I mean? So that's another reason why this isn't quite as simple as they would make it. And then, of course, the third reason, and this is one that, again, this is the question I asked Chris Christie on Twitter. And he refused to, he probably didn't see it, so I'm not even going to blame him. He probably doesn't run his own Twitter. Most politicians have people doing that for them. Donald Trump is like the one guy who just sits on it all day, right? But the question I asked Christie, and it is a question I have asked at least a half a dozen different conservatives on Twitter in the last month, and I have not gotten an answer yet. And I think the only reason I'm not getting one is because they can't give one. But now it's becoming a prevalent issue, right? If you saw this report, it just came out. It was on, there was a piece on Huffington Post yesterday that there are a number of companies now. The piece initially talked about Carvana, you know, the car company that they're the ones that have the big tubes filled with cars and you can see them. And I don't know what they do. They drive the car down the tube. I don't know what the hell. I don't know what Carvana is, but it's some kind of place you go, you get a car, you don't have to haggle over the price. It's like CarMax, I think. I have no idea what their business model is. I just know they got these big tubes filled with cars and you can see them off the interstate here in Nashville. The Carvana folks, one of their executives, sent out a memo to their employees. And what this memo said was essentially, and you can read the story over on Huffington Post right now, essentially said, look, we know this is a horrible time, but we got to get back to work. So we need all of our associates to, you know, you got to make a decision. Either you're coming back to work or we're going to have to replace you. So here you have a, and they're not going to be alone in this. And I've been saying this for well over a month, right? That if we push to reopen and if quote unquote non-essential businesses get the green light to reopen, that was what was going to happen, that they are going to look at their existing employees who maybe haven't been working for a while and say, look, you got to make a choice, your money or your life, in effect. You want this job, you got to come back to work, you got to take the risk. You know, maybe they're going to require masks, maybe they're not going to require masks, maybe they're going to have good social distancing practices, maybe they're not, but hey, you know, it's up to you. You want to take a gamble or you want to stay at home? And if you want to stay at home, good luck and God bless, but we got to move on and hire somebody to take your place. This is the question I asked Chris Christie. What do you do? And again, I'm asking it of anyone who's listening to this program who is in the open it back up camp, who is in the anti-lockdown, we got to get back to normal camp. Okay, fine. Tell me, please, what do we do with people who work currently for companies where maybe they're not working, maybe they are sheltering in place, maybe they are locked down right now, who, when we open back up, cannot risk going back because they are older. Again, lots of people who are older have not retired yet, still working, or because regardless of age, they have asthma, they have COPD, they have diabetes, they have high blood pressure, they have a heart, you know, some type of heart disease. These are all things that normally would be conditions that you could work with, right? People, I have asthma, doesn't stop me from working. I travel, I go through airports, I sometimes have to run through airports. You know, as long as I take my medicine, I manage my asthma, I'm good. It doesn't keep you from working. Same thing with diabetes. Folks work with diabetes all the time. Folks work with high blood pressure all the time. Folks work with heart disease all the time. People that are obese work all the time. These are all manageable conditions in a normal world. But in a pandemic world where those comorbidities are highly associated with really bad health outcomes in the midst of a virus like this, it is quite reasonable. And even Chris Christie and these Republicans and these conservatives admit it's reasonable for those folks to stay sheltered in place. I don't hear any of them saying that they expect asthmatics and diabetics and people with pre-existing conditions to go back to work. Even the most heartless, wacky lunatic of these people at the rallies isn't saying that. I don't hear any of them mocking people with diabetes or people with asthma saying, oh, you're just a pansy, why don't you go back to work? But here we have the harsh reality is, there are lots of people, millions of people. I'd be willing to bet it is a pretty sizable plurality of the American labor force that either falls into a high-risk group themselves or lives in a home with someone who falls into a high-risk group. When you take all the folks that are, you know, 60 or over and or have diabetes and or have asthma and or have COPD and or have heart disease and or are obese, all these different things that we know put you in a higher risk group. I'd be willing to bet that, and I haven't crunched the numbers, but if you know these numbers or want to look them up, hit me up with an email, let me know what they are. I'll be happy to report them next time. It's got to be, if not a majority of the American population, certainly a pretty sizable plurality who either fall into those categories or live with someone who does. So really what the open up people are saying is those folks, and what Carvana is now proving as a company, and they're not going to be alone in this, is we are going to be in a situation not simply where healthy young people can choose to gamble and take the risk for themselves, which I suppose is their right philosophically and morally. But what it means in this particular instance is you're saying not only that those folks should have the right to gamble with their lives, but that people who are in a high-risk group should be given a Hobbesian choice of, hey, you either go back to work and risk your life, or you stay at home and you lose your job. So what you're really saying is to the people with pre-existing conditions, you don't really have a choice. You don't. You're going to be forced to gamble with your life if you want to be able to pay your family's bills. So it's not just that these folks are gambling with their life. They're saying you have to gamble with yours, because these are not people, so far as I can tell, and this is the way that I frame the question to Chris Christie, these are not people who say, oh yeah, y'all should be able to shelter in place and we want the government to pay your bills for the next 6 months until we get to the other side. I don't hear them saying that. Maybe if they were saying that, I would not have a point here. But my point is, these are people who were saying, yes, 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 this group, if you want to stay home, you can, but the rest of us have to go back to work. But unless you are prepared to demand that the state step in and provide the safety net necessary to get those people through, those who are older, those who have pre-existing conditions, those who cannot work or are afraid to work because of their own health or the health of someone in their home, then you're forcing them to gamble with their lives. And I haven't heard any of these conservatives, any of these Republicans say, yes, we support, like, let's, for instance, you know, long-term disability, or even just shorter medium term. Like, you could theoretically imagine a scenario where we did what the Chris Christies of the world are saying we ought to do, but we said to people, hey, look, if you're in one of those groups and you, or you're afraid of going back to work because you're afraid of either contracting the virus or passing it to a loved one in your home who has a pre-existing condition, you can stay home and, you know, we're going to have a disability payment plan that's going to be sufficient, you know, to pay your bills till we get to the other side of this thing. I haven't heard a single Republican say that. And I'm not going to. I'm not going to. You're not going to hear any conservatives endorse that. What they're going to say is, no, you got to make a choice. We live in a free market, baby. It's capitalism or bust. So if you want your job, you're going to have to go back and, you know, good luck with that. What we're really saying is that we're willing to gamble not with our own lives, but with other people's lives for the sake of maintaining a particular kind of economic policy of limited state intervention, because these folks do not want more government intervention. In fact, they want less, right? We have people like Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott, the senators from South Carolina, and others who are upset about the supposed generosity of existing unemployment benefits, right? So as I said at sort of top of the program, right, we have these unemployment benefits, which normally they're run by the state and different states have different limits, right? And under the original CARES Act, the feds added $600 a week on top of whatever your state provides. And that was a pretty good boost, actually, because most states don't provide anywhere near that. Like Tennessee, where I live, I think the maximum is $275. So if you add $600 to that, now you can get $875 a week, right, in unemployment. Now, that's only through July. And then after the end of July, unless they extend that, once we get into August, right, it's going to go back to the $275 a week, which is clearly not sufficient. But the $875 a week actually would sustain, you know, a lot of families. The median income in the state of Tennessee, that would probably sustain a lot of people and get them through. But you have people like Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott and others on the right who are screaming and yelling about that $600, because they say, well, you know, some of these folks now, depending on what state they're in, are going to be getting more money to stay home than they would to go back to their jobs. So they have no incentive to go back to work because they get paid more to just sit around. Now, Lindsey Graham said the other day, he's not trying to imply that these folks are lazy. It's just, they're just responding to incentives. Of course, there are lots of problems with that argument. Number one, the whole point in a pandemic is trying to limit how many people have to go back to work. That's sort of the idea. When you've got a major public health emergency and it's the result of viruses spreading, you want fewer people out there rather than more. So if in fact it's a disincentive to work, that's the point, until we get on the other side of this. But the second problem is that it reveals the mentality at work here, right? Which is that if we go in the direction that the right wants us to, and that some of you listening to this program who may not even be on the right per se want us to go, which is opening things back up, are you prepared to push for and to fight for the kinds of government intervention, medium to long-term disability payments, enhanced stimulus package, whatever, bigger safety net, extended unemployment benefits for people who cannot take that risk? Because it's not enough to say on the one hand, oh yeah, yeah, no, we totally understand it's too risky for you or your family for you to go back to work. But then on the other hand, you're also saying, yeah, and by the way, no more safety net, no more government support, right? It's all back to the free market. You're literally signing people's death warrants then. Because what you're saying is it's your money or your life. And in that situation, I know what people are going to do. They're going to go back to work and they're going to die. So you're sending them to their death. It's one thing to gamble with your life. It's quite another to force other people who have pre-existing conditions to gamble with theirs. And this really reveals, y'all, an underlying mentality at the heart of conservative thinking. This is why, for years, conservatives have fought and are still fighting the Trump administration right now in court, fighting Obamacare and wanting to get the whole thing repealed. You know, Donald Trump and the right, they'll say, oh, yeah, we're going to have a replacement bill and it's going to protect pre-existing conditions, but they don't have such a bill. They don't have a bill that protects pre-existing conditions. They don't have a substitute piece of legislation that protects pre-existing conditions that says you cannot deny care on the basis of that or that you cannot raise price on the basis of that. They don't, because they don't believe in that. They say they do, but they're lying. They're in court right now trying to overthrow the whole thing, and they have no substitute that covers it. Why? Because they fundamentally believe that covering pre-existing conditions is a form of a handout. You don't believe me? Rush Limbaugh said this during the debate over the Affordable Care Act. He actually went on the air and told his 20 million or whatever the hell it is listeners, and he got no pushback on it, by the way, that covering pre-existing conditions, forcing insurers to cover people with pre-existing conditions, is just welfare. It's just a handout. And in Rush Limbaugh's mind, of course, it's a handout to undeserving people, because at the bottom line, people on the right believe, and some of them more so than others perhaps, but there's something about that mindset that looks at people with pre-existing conditions as somehow being undeserving. It's your fault that you're sick. It's your fault that you have diabetes. It's your fault that you have high blood pressure. It's your fault that you're overweight. It's your fault that you're whatever. And is it true that Americans have some really shitty habits that cause us to have worse health? Absolutely. Is it true that we eat like shit? You know, is it true that we drink too much? Is it true that we don't exercise enough? Yeah. It's also true that we eat a lot of processed foods because that's what's made more readily available by big business. It's also true that we live in a lot of spaces that don't have good places for recreation, for people to safely get together and do the exercising and the recreation that they could do. It's also true that we have a lot of agribusiness that pumps out a lot of sugary products to us. And so, yeah, there's some personal responsibility piece, but there's also a lot of collective responsibility, and we're sort of all falling down on the job. All of us could probably stand to eat better. All of us could probably stand to exercise more. So, is that true? Yes, it's true, but still, to suggest that people have illness because of their own irresponsible behavior ignores how most people end up with cancer. It's not because they smoke 3 packs a day. And even if they did smoke cigarettes for years, right? We know that tobacco is an addictive product. The tobacco companies knew they were pushing an addictive product. They covered that up. They hooked people and resulted in millions of deaths around the world. There are a lot of reasons why we have a lot of sick people. Some of them we could mitigate to a large extent with some better behaviors, but that's all of us, right? That's all of us. The fact that some of us engage in sort of bad dietary habits and get sick as a result, and others eat the same shit and stay relatively healthy, tells you it ain't just about behavior. I lived in New Orleans for 10 years, and I've lived in the South all my life. We eat a lot less healthy here than folks in Colorado, for instance. And people in Colorado, much more likely to get out and recreate and exercise. But do you know why? It's not because they're culturally superior, better people. It's because there's space to do that and the climate is more conducive to it. If you live in the South is hot as hell for large sections of the calendar year. And getting out and running, getting out and walking when it's 90 degrees and 90% humidity is a lot different experience than doing the same thing, going for a hike when it's in the 70s and the humidity's in the 30s or less. So you have certain parts of the country where it's easier, frankly, to take care of yourself. It's easier to eat healthier. It's easier to exercise. And we have a history in the South of eating like crap. But the difference is white folks and black folks all eat like crap. Rich folks and poor folks all eat like crap. And when I say eat like crap, I mean eat really good. Like in New Orleans, we all ate really good, but sometimes it was really bad, right? Not necessarily the best food for you, but really good in terms of taste. And we all ate the same thing. The difference was the wealthy folks who ate that food still pretty healthy. Why? Because they have good preventative care, right? Not because their behavior is any different, but because they have access to good health care and maybe the gym and the personal trainer. And poor folks and working class folks who eat the same thing don't have the same access to that. So it isn't really about behavior. We're all eating like shit. And some are affected much more by it than others because of these other factors. But if you're on the right, what you're basically saying is that to hell with people with pre-existing conditions. We saw it in the debate over Obamacare, right? We're seeing it now in the Trump administration trying to overturn Obamacare with no way of protecting people with pre-existing conditions if they succeed in doing that. And we're seeing it in regard to the open it up brigades who want to stop the lockdown. In effect, what they're saying is, sorry if you're sick, sorry if you've got diabetes, sorry if you've got high blood pressure, sorry if you've got asthma, but it's your money or your life. It is a cavalier attitude toward people who are, I guess, less healthy. And really, it stems from a mentality that at some level, their lives are not as valuable, that they are expendable. It's really a eugenic mentality. It's a social Darwinist survival of the fittest mentality. And I know some people hearing this are going to get bent out of shape about me calling it social Darwinism, because I realize it's really Herbert Spencer who said survival of the fittest, not Charles Darwin. So really, it's social Spencerianism, but nobody knows what the hell that is. So that's why I said social Darwinism. It's this idea that, well, the strong will survive and the weak won't, and that's the way it was supposed to be. And it's the kind of mentality that was at the heart of Hitlerism. And that mentality, of course, was borrowed, frankly, from American scientists and academics at Harvard, at Princeton, at Columbia, at Stanford, and other leading institutions of higher education in America, where the eugenicists of the late 19th century, early 20th century held sway with their ideas of superior and inferior specimens of mankind, which of course was always very racialized and very culture bound and, you know, very ethnic in origin, but also just this idea of superior and inferior people. And it may not always be articulated as blatantly. Usually it's not. Usually it's not as blatant as Hitler made it. It's usually not as blatant as neo-Nazis today would make it. But the mentality that says certain people are sacrificable, oddly, coming from the same people who say all lives matter when they're trying to bash Black Lives Matter, there was all lives matter, but they don't really mean that shit. They don't believe all lives matter. They think certain lives matter more than others. And what they're saying is that Black folks and brown folks' lives don't matter as much. Working class people's lives don't matter as much. Old folks' lives don't matter as much. And people with pre-existing conditions' lives don't matter as much. And you may be hearing that and saying, well, now, Tim, that's not fair. That's hyperbole on your part. You're assuming something about them that you can't prove just because they want to open up the economy. Oh, I think I can prove it. Here's how I can prove it. Very simple thought experiment, one that I have offered on Twitter a few times. Once again, no one has been able to take issue with it or even really tried. Here's the thought experiment. Imagine for a second that COVID-19, rather than disproportionately affecting people of color, which is what it's doing, rather than disproportionately affecting working class and lower income people, which is what it's doing, rather than disproportionately affecting the elderly, which is what it's doing, and rather than disproportionately affecting people with pre-existing conditions of one type or another, which is what it's doing, let's imagine that instead of all that, it was disproportionately affecting white folks, disproportionately affecting middle class, upper middle class, affluent folks, disproportionately affecting people who were in the prime of their lives, and disproportionately affecting people who were relatively healthy. Let's just imagine, for some unexplained reason, that that's what this virus was doing, that it was attacking the exact opposite demographics of what it's actually attacking right now. In that situation, does anyone actually honestly believe that the same people, or any significant sizable number of people at all, would be out in the streets going up to state capitals and protesting for a mass reopening of all business and reopening the economy? Do we actually believe that the folks who are doing that now, knowing that this virus disproportionately affects people of color, working class folks, old folks, and people who are ill, that would they be doing the same thing if it was mostly going to affect white folks, affluent folks, prime of their life folks, and people who were healthy? And the answer is hell no. The only reason that they are able to go out there and demand to open it back up is because, bottom line, they really don't think they're going to be the ones at risk. If they really thought that they were going to be at risk, they wouldn't take that chance. They wouldn't. Nobody would. You would not take that risk if you honestly believed that it was going to be you. So on the one hand, it's just sort of a generic sort of nonchalance, right? That isn't just about racial or class or age or status of disability or health. It's just sort of a general naivete and an innocence that says it won't happen to me, and that's why I'm willing to take the chance. But if this were affecting people like the people who are disproportionately at these rallies, who are in fact white, who are in fact middle class, or in many cases above, frankly, the fact that they are willing to go out and demand the reopening of the economy is a function of who they believe is truly at risk. Because they know some people are. They have said as much. They have acknowledged, most of them, not the ones who say it's a hoax, not them. But a lot of folks are like, yeah, we know we're going to lose some people. Right, you're going to lose some black and brown folks disproportionately. About a third nationwide right now. You're going to lose working class people, lower income folks disproportionately. You're going to lose people who have pre-existing conditions, and you are saying that is acceptable loss because it's not you. So by definition, if that thought experiment is true and you would respond differently if the people being affected were disproportionately white, disproportionately upper middle class, disproportionately in like their 20s and 30s or whatever, and disproportionately healthy, what you are saying, if you would respond differently to them, if you would support lockdowns in that situation, if you would demand government support to get people through the crisis if it were hitting those folks, but you don't do that now, you are by definition saying that black and brown life is of less value. Whether you intend to say that or not, that's what you're saying. Maybe you don't think of it consciously, but that's what you're saying. You are saying that lower income folks, regardless of color, are of less value than upper middle class and affluent people. Maybe you're not deliberately saying it, but it's what you're saying. You are saying that older folks are of less value than younger folks. You are saying that people with a pre-existing condition, even one with which you could normally work and function just fine, that your life is now worth less than someone who doesn't have one of those things. So you are guilty of, by definition, not because I say so, but because basic logic says so, you are guilty of racism, classism, ableism, and ageism, by definition, if you would respond differently, and you know damn well that you would. So if you're somebody who says open it up now but wouldn't do it if it was affecting the opposite demographics, you are engaged in racism, classism, ableism, and ageism by definition, and ought to be called on the carpet for that. Second thought experiment, because this also points out the absurdity of the Hobbesian choice that the right is offering us right now. Second thought experiment. Imagine for a second that this virus was so transmissible, so contagious, that it could travel, I don't know, 100 yards. Let's say it was so aerosolized that, you know, if you have it and you breathe into the air, that the spores or whatever, that the viral particles can travel 100 yards at a time, so that it's super dangerous, super easy to catch, much higher transmissibility even than what it has right now. So much so that it's really dangerous to go outside, like, you know, almost like a chemical weapons attack. Now, in that situation, would people be clamoring for and demanding a reopening of the economy? Absolutely not. People would be angry, they would be scared, but they would also be sheltering the hell in place, and we'd be trying to figure out how the hell are we going to, you know, support essential workers to get them to and from. We'd probably have to, you know, create like PPE spacesuit kind of things for people to wear that deliver packages and work in grocery stores and work in hospitals, because it'd be so incredibly deadly. We certainly would not be having this cavalier attitude about going to get your damn hair cut, going to, you know, sit down restaurants, reopening, you know, sporting events and concert venues and, you know, opening everything back up, because people would be freaked the hell out. In that situation, I realize it's not that dangerous, but the point of thought experiments is to game it out hypothetically, right? If hypothetically it were that dangerous, what do you think we as a society would be calling for and what we would be doing? You know the answer. We would absolutely not be taking chances with people's lives that way. We would be developing whatever government intervention was needed to get people through the crisis. In other words, we could do that. The fact that we would do that in the alternative scenario suggests that there is a different path that we could take now. The fact that we're not taking it now is because we are deciding that the lives that are truly at risk right now are not as important as the lives that would be at risk in that second scenario. We're saying that it's not worth doing the government intervention. Not that it couldn't be done. It's not a function of, oh my God, there's no other choice. There is. It's that we're saying we're not willing to make that choice now when it might only be a couple hundred thousand people who die. But if it were like a chemical weapons attack, and if it were, you know, so transmissible that it could travel 100 yards and virtually anytime you walked out without like a spacesuit kind of thing, you're likely to get it, we would absolutely be doing it. We would be printing money and distributing it. We would be doing what Denmark right now, I've talked about this before, and I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but we would be doing what Denmark is doing. What are they doing? They are essentially distributing cash. They are giving people the equivalent of, I think it's 52 or 53,000 American dollars to get through the crisis. The equivalent of that as an annual income to get through the crisis, right? Essentially saying we are going to put our economy on hold, get people through, and then we'll open it back up when it's over. They are having that response. We could do that. And if we were facing a virus with the danger and the virality of the second thought experiment that I mentioned, or to be honest with you, even the first thought experiment where the victims are disproportionately white, disproportionately middle class and above, disproportionately prime of life and disproportionately healthy. In that situation, even with the current virus and the level of virality involved, I believe that we would be calling for programs more like what we're seeing in Denmark and in other European countries. We would be having that kind of big government response, but we're not right now. And it begs the question, why? Why would the response be different if the virus were doing what I said in scenario one, which is same virus we have now, but disproportionately affecting different demographics? Or alternative scenario number two, regardless of demographics, it's deadly as hell. Everybody's going to get it. You got to stay inside. We would do that. So the fact that we're not doing it now says that at some level, we don't value the lives of the people who are disproportionately affected the way we would other lives, and that we are not willing to consider serious government support for folks as things are right now, even though we could do that. What we're really saying is our commitment to the ideology of small government, our commitment to the ideology of no handouts, our commitment to the ideology of not having the government intervene to support people is more important to us than the loss of, let's say, 150 or 200,000 or 300,000 lives, which is what the estimates suggest it could be if we, quote unquote, open everything back up and, you know, sort of abandon the social distancing that we've been doing for the past 6 weeks. We're saying that those 300,000 lives, which are other people's lives, is what we're really saying, because we're not really thinking that we're going to get it. We're saying those other 300,000 people, that it's worth sacrificing them for what Chris Christie called on TV last night, the American way of life. The American way of life, meaning government doesn't support people, people support themselves, by God. But if this were on the level of danger of a chemical weapons attack, we would dispense with that. We absolutely would. We would understand that for right now, we're in such a crisis, we have to do extraordinary measures. The only reason we're not doing extraordinary measures now is we just don't think it's that big a deal. And the reason we don't think it's that big a deal is it ain't us dying. And then that begs the question, why? Why do they not want government intervention? Is it just some philosophical thing? Is it just that America is filled with hardcore libertarians? No. If America were filled with hardcore libertarians, Reason Magazine would have a higher circulation and the Libertarian Party would have the control of the United States Congress, the House, and the Senate, and Ron Paul would have gotten more votes when he ran for president 75 different times or whatever the hell he's done, right? We're not a country filled with libertarians. So it's not a philosophical thing. Is it some kind of pride thing? Like, well, we don't want to be like Denmark because, you know, America's better than Denmark. Well, first of all, most people couldn't find Denmark on a map if their lives depended on it. Don't know anything about it. So it's not just some pride thing. It's not like there's something wrong, you know, the American way is better than the Denmark way. Well, what's wrong with Denmark? Are they like an unfree country? No, Denmark is a very free country. It's not as if Denmark doing this big intervention on behalf of people is some form of, you know, huge totalitarian government response. I know there are some people at these rallies who keep saying, you know, government intervention and the shutdown is communism. Denmark's not communist. Denmark's not even really socialist. It's like a social democracy. They, you know, it's a big safety net, but it's still a mixed economy. When people make that argument, it's not about that. It's not about like, oh, we don't want to become that authoritarian hellhole like Denmark is. It's not. Why is it that the United States doesn't want to move in that direction? And really, if you want the answer to that, y'all, you have to go back to what the research has been telling us for a number of years in terms of why the United States has such weak safety nets relative to pretty much every other Western industrialized nation with which we like to compare ourselves, because it is true that our safety nets are far less extensive than those other countries. And the research on that is incredibly clear. It is not simply a function of weaker labor unions or the lack of a labor party. That's what some people would claim. But it is a function of something else. And the something else both explains the weak legislative support for safety nets, and by the way, is correlated with the weaker labor unions and the lack of a labor party. And you know what that is? Surprise, surprise. It is the racial demographic of this country and the belief on the part of white Americans that if we had bigger social safety nets, black people and other folks of color would take advantage of the programs and cheat. That is literally one of, if not the most highly correlated factor to explain why we have such weak safety nets, according to a ton of different research. There was research came out of Harvard a couple years ago, broke down all these different factors and did all this multivariate analysis. And what they found was that of all the different factors that explain the weakness of our safety nets, it is that belief, it is that racialized resentment, the belief that those people, where those people are black and brown, are going to abuse the programs, that leads white Americans to countenance weaker social safety nets, even programs from which we would benefit, whether it's universal health care, paid leave, child care, whatever it is, right? Housing assistance, nutrition assistance, income support, whatever it is. We support less of it because there is a belief that those people will abuse the program. Whereas when you look at some of these Western industrialized nations in Europe, which are more ethnically, culturally homogenous, they're not as ethnically and culturally homogenous and racially homogenous as we might think, but they're more so than the United States, which is very much sort of a multiracial nation, right? In those countries where there's more of a homogeneity, there is less resentment towards people getting those benefits, because the people getting the benefits are like your cousin, it's like your neighbor, it's you, it's, you know, it's people you know, it's people like you. But if you perceive that those people are going to get the benefits, well, oh my God, I don't want those to get, because they don't deserve them. So we don't mind big government in this country as long as we think the people who are going to get the benefits are like us. It's why during the Tea Party stuff, you had these old white folks, these right-wing white folks who were out at the anti-Obamacare rallies, right? And the Tea Party rallies with signs that said, get your government hands off my Medicare. Get the government out of my Medicare. What the fuck do you think Medicare is? What do you think, Blue Cross runs that shit? That's government, Grandpa. But it's not, see, not in the same way. Because the folks who are on Medicare think, well, that's different. That's not like Medicaid, you see. Medicaid is for those poor black people. Actually, disproportionate number of Medicaid dollars are not spent on people of color, actually. But there is a perception, right? And the perception means that we're going to have less of those programs. The perception is that if you have universal health care, guaranteed benefits, those people are going to take advantage. So we end up keeping a system that actually puts millions of people at risk and costs tens of thousands of lives a year, according even to the most conservative estimates, right? Maybe 20, 25, 30,000 people die every year because of a lack of adequate health care because they can't afford it, right? Some estimates place that number much, much higher. But whatever number, even if you take the lowball estimate of what, 20,000, 25,000 deaths annually because we don't have universal guaranteed healthcare, but it's an acceptable loss to us just to keep those people from taking advantage of the program. And I got news for you. Part of this open it back up brigade thing, even if it's not conscious, even if it's not deliberate, is the result of people saying that we would rather roll the dice with a couple hundred thousand lives, A, because we don't think it's going to be us, B, we don't think it's going to be anybody really close to us or like us, and C, we'd rather gamble with those other people's lives than have the government intervene and maybe, I don't know, throw some money at people who we think don't deserve it because they're lazy and don't work hard. Like, we're more committed to the ideology of small government, and it's not because we're particularly philosophically committed to libertarianism. It's not because we're a particularly ideologically conservative nation. It's that we believe big government and government intervention means too much for those people, not enough for people like us. If the United States was as monocultural, as homogenous as a lot of those other European nations, we would have a much bigger welfare state and probably far fewer people clamoring to open it back up so we can all get back to work. But we have decided that we want people to go back to work because if the government helps them, it coddles them, it gives them handouts, and not just them, but particular types of people. This is how race is implicated in this thing, even when it's not obvious. This is how race and racial resentment, as the sort of modern manifestation of white supremacy, racial resentment, the idea that undeserving black and brown others are getting too much and deserving white folks are getting too little, is at the heart of why we're willing to take this risk. Because if it were mostly affecting white folks, if it were mostly affecting the affluent, or if it were just so dangerous that it was really like risky to go out of the house without some type of spacesuit kind of thing on, we would be calling for that massive government intervention. The reason that we're not is that we just don't care enough about the people who are going to be lost in the current scenario as we would in those alternative scenarios. We're more committed to the ideology of small government than we are to those hundreds of thousands of lives, and we're more committed to that ideology of small government because it dovetails with our resentment and our racial anxieties about black and brown people abusing the program and getting one over on us. We would rather a couple hundred thousand people die than countenance the possibility that maybe some folks who we think shouldn't get some money from the government might get money from the government and not have to work. Think about that. That's where we are right now as a society. Even the people who don't intend for that to be the outcome, that is the outcome of the open it up brigade's arguments. And let's just be honest, one final thing before I'm done. This idea that we can reopen the economy even if millions of people who are older or have pre-existing conditions stay in place, because that's, again, that's the offer they're offering. They're saying, we want to go back to work, but if y'all want to stay home, hey, we totally understand. You do you, we do us. Do you understand that there are so many millions of people who aren't going to go out? They're not, because they can't. It's too risky to them. It's too risky to people and their families. There are millions of people who, even if y'all go back to quote-unquote normal, we ain't coming. And when we don't come, do you understand? Your business ain't going to make it. Like, your restaurant is not going to make it. You know, your whatever, antique store, whatever the hell, you know, your photography shop, your general store, your whatever it is that you do for a living, whatever job it is you have that you think you can just reopen, but then you got like 40% of the country that isn't going out because they can't afford it. They're not going to be buying your shit. If they're not buying your shit, you're not selling your shit. You're not going to be able to get the economy jump-started on the backs of half the consumers and half of the dollars that otherwise would be available. So at the end of the day, even the people who want to get back to normal, you're not going to be getting back to normal. And it's time for us as a country to face that we're going to have to create a new normal. The question is whether that new normal is going to be one that asks us your money or your life and puts us in a position of having to choose our money or our lives or the lives of our family members and our kids and loved ones, or whether we're going to create a new society rooted in solidarity that says we have an obligation to take care of one another and to prioritize the whole, not just to prioritize your individual liberty and freedom to go do what you want, when you want, however you want, but the importance of keeping us together as a society, as a functioning nation. That is the question that we have to answer, and it's the question that no conservatives at this point have been willing to even look at. And that'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram.